Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Global trade is always a contact sport. But the play between the U.S. and China is getting a little rough lately. U.S. voices charging China is essentially cheating with currency manipulation, tilting the field its way. Both countries worried about hanging on to jobs and stability, and it could get uglier soon. This hour on Point, rising tension between the world's biggest trading partners. You can join the conversation. Does Beijing have a boot on the throat of American recovery, as Charles Schumer says? Can these giants afford trade war or anything like it? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Last week, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner appearing before Congress, talking about, voicing some measured criticism of the Chinese government for its currency policies.
China is running a set of policies that are designed to keep the currency undervalued.
Right.
It is undervalued. They are moving to let it rise, but not very quickly.
That's the polite version. Here's New York Senator Charles Schumer voicing strong criticism of China's currency policy.
At a time when the U.S. economy is trying to pick itself up off the ground, China's currency manipulation is like a boot to the throat of our recovery, and this administration refuses to try and take that boot off our neck.
A boot to the throat. Oh, boy. Joining me first today from Washington is Sewell Chan, economics reporter for the New York Times. Sewell, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, Tom.
Give us a sense of where this stands. Ever since last summer, the U.S. has been pushing hard with China. China has done some responding. What's happened so far, and what are the steps ahead of us, Sewell?
Sure. Well, what's happened so far is in some ways a repeat of what happened about 5 years ago. The issue goes back by about a decade. Mm-hmm. And basically, successive administrations, really first Clinton and then Bush, and now the Obama administration, have been very reluctant to formally declare China a currency manipulator. It's almost become like the M word in Washington. And Geithner kind of carefully danced around the topic last week. He would not use the word manipulation, but basically made it clear, using every other word possible, that the administration does in fact believe that China, you know, is substantially undervaluing its currency to gain an export and to gain an advantage in its exports. What comes up ahead is a few different things. There's another opportunity on October 15th when the Treasury Department's next report to Congress on exchange rates is due for the U.S. to declare China a manipulator. That's very, very unlikely to happen. It will be right before the midterm election. It is seen by the administration as an action that would antagonize the Chinese without actually yielding much in the way of positive results. And so this is likely to drag on, definitely through the G20, when the leaders of the world's biggest economies gather in South Korea to talk about issues. Currency is expected to be one of the top items on their agenda.
Sewell, why does an undervalued Chinese currency, if that's what it is, an undervalued yuan, why does it help Chinese exports?
Sure. So exchange rates are pretty, seem complicated, but essentially what they do is just determine the relative prices of goods in different countries. And when China keeps its yuan, or also known as the renminbi, mm-hmm. artificially low, and we can talk in a moment about how it does that, the effect is to make Chinese products relatively cheap and products from outside China relatively more expensive. For China, this has been an important strategy because so much of their economy is driven by exports. Obviously, they've had this enormous manufacturing boom, especially concentrated on the southern coast of China, and their economy was driven for so much of the past decade by consumption in the rest of the world, particularly in wealthy countries like the United States. So for China, their exporters gain tremendously when their goods are relatively cheap.
How do you keep a currency undervalued? How's that done, if that's what's going on?
Sure. What China, each country can essentially make unlimited amounts of its own currency, right? There are limits to how wise it is to do that. But China essentially creates a lot of its own currency, the renminbi, and uses that currency to buy dollars. It can buy dollars by just exchanging them on foreign exchange markets. It can also buy U.S. Treasury securities. which is one reason why the China owns so much of the U.S. government's official debt.
So they buy that to keep their currency down. Congress is getting in on this. There is a threat of congressional, of legislative action. What is that, Sewell?
Well, that's right. If you know, things get really, really bad, Congress, of course, could, you know, threaten to or even enact protectionist measures. These would protect American exporters and American manufacturers by imposing, for example, tariffs on Chinese goods. In general, economists think that that's a really bad idea. In the 1920s and 1930s in particular, when the world slipped into depression, every country ended up enacting protectionist measures against other countries, you know, the Smoot-Hawley tariff in the U.S. and all that, and sort of everyone kind of isolated themselves. And that's actually not good for the global economy in the long run. You know, trade is supposed to produce net benefits for the world economy. And so that's sort of the fear. But the question is how much the Chinese, frankly, believe the congressional anger that's been expressed. To some extent, the Obama administration actually benefits from and might even be encouraging Congress to express its anger, because that gives the U.S. negotiating leverage when we talk to the Chinese in asking them, you know, you better act, otherwise there could really be these negative consequences.
And what are the consequences if China were to be named a currency manipulator by the U.S.? What would follow from that? You say it's the third rail.
Right. Those consequences aren't huge. They would essentially just require the U.S. to engage in more talks, frankly. And that's partly why the Obama administration doesn't want to go down that route. If you declare someone a manipulator, it's not like, you know, some court swoops in and, you know, tells China they've been a bad boy. What is essentially triggered is a lot more negotiations, and they've already been negotiating. So they kind of don't want to play that. The U.S., we don't want to play that Trump card until we kind of have to, is kind of the attitude that I'm hearing.
But there's a lot of sound about this as we look at high unemployment in this country, as the midterm elections come forward, as people are looking for something, somewhere to point, something to shout about.
Well, absolutely. In a way, I'm surprised it hasn't gotten even more attention, because it's one of the rare issues that doesn't break down cleanly along Republican and Democratic lines. You know, I should note, Tom, that the currency issue is one that the business community, frankly, is divided on. If you're a Midwest manufacturer, a factory, a maker of specialty steel or aluminum products, you are furious about the Chinese right now, because you feel they're rigging the game, they're placing unfair pressure on your business. In some cases, they're driving your jobs out of the U.S. and forcing you to relocate them overseas just to compete. But other business interests in America, including very large multinational companies and Wall Street financial firms, they're actually okay with China having a weaker currency. Now, why is that? Part of the reason is that the large multinationals, many of them have manufacturing facilities overseas and in China. So they benefit from the cheaper Chinese currency, the weaker currency, just like the Chinese do.
So there's kind of divided interests there. So
Wall Street doesn't mind having the currency be weak, because Wall Street wants to do a lot of business in China. A strong dollar is relatively better for them. They like the idea of, you know, getting in on all this business that's developing in China as China's capital markets grow. Wall Street wants to get involved in that. So the interests are very complex, and you have a lot of powerful business interests that don't really support a stronger Chinese currency. And that's one reason why Congress, although very critical, has been behind the scenes somewhat divided on the issue.
Sewell Chan covers economics for The New York Times, joined us in Washington. Sewell, you're terrific. Thank you very much for being here.
Tom, thanks so much.
Here's Senator Chris Dodd last week with some tough words for the Obama administration on China policy. He said Treasury Secretary Geithner needed to get tougher with China, and fast.
While it is clear China currency is undervalued, the Treasury has been reluctant, in my view, to label China a currency manipulator. So, Mr. Secretary, with so many Americans out of work, struggling to make ends meet, we're eager to hear an explanation for this continued reluctance to act.
Joining us right now from Washington is Robert Scott, senior international economist at the Economic Policy Institute. He sees 500,000 American jobs at stake, at least in the U.S.-China standoff right now. Robert Scott, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
How do you come up with that? What are you saying? If China set its currency at a fair level, there would be 500,000 more American jobs created? Really?
I would say at least 500,000, perhaps as many as 1 million jobs could be created just by getting China to revalue its currency. That estimate that you cite is just the number of jobs we're going to lose this year given the growth in China's trade surplus with the United States.
How far off do you think China's currency is, and is it clear that it's being manipulated to that point?
The best estimates are that it's anywhere from 25 to 40% undervalued. It means it acts like a 25 to 40% subsidy on everything that China sells to the United States and a tax on everything that the U.S. might want to sell, not only in China, but in all other countries where we compete with China. And that's really, the hidden part of the problem.
So 500,000 or a million jobs, like what kind of jobs, Robert?
Those jobs would, about 60% of them would be in manufacturing, in sectors like machine tools and aircraft and other advanced manufactured products that we are already exporting to the rest of the world. Those exports would go up.
Do you think it's realistic that China is going to make a 25 to 45% shift in its currency, or is this just blowing smoke, whistling in the wind here?
Well, they've already done it once. In 2005, they were threatened with 27% tariffs in a bill that got 67 votes in the Senate. It got a veto-proof majority on a procedural vote, never became law. And simply the fact that the Senate voted on that, I think, had a huge impact on Chinese policy. They let their currency begin to rise rapidly. It rose about to 20 to 25% between 2005 and 2008. Mm. So they've shown willingness to negotiate when we were willing to get tough.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China and the U.S. economy, the dollar, the Chinese yuan, and mounting trade tensions between these giant trade partners. In a town hall meeting yesterday in Washington, President Obama responded to questions about U.S.-China relations.
What we've said to them is you need to let your currency rise in accordance to the fact that your economy is rising, you're getting wealthier, you're exporting a lot. There should be an adjustment there based on market conditions. They have said yes in theory, but in fact, they have not done everything that needs to be done.
There's tension here. It's a political season. Here's Richard Shelby at that hearing last week, Republican of Alabama, senator, using the occasion to scold China for its currency policy and saying President Obama needs to do more.
I believe that it's time, that the time for talking has long passed and the time for action has arrived. It's time for this administration to recognize the consequences of China's manipulation for American workers and manufacturers.
Robert Scott has joined us from the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. And right now, joining us as well from Ithaca, New York, is Ishwar Prasad, Senior Professor of Trade Policy at Cornell University, Research Associate at the National Bureau for Economic Research, and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, a former head of the China Division of the International Monetary Fund. Ishwar Prasad, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Pleasure to be back on your show, Tom.
So Robert Scott looks at the numbers and says, you know what, if China got its currency in the right place, not manipulated, we could gain in pretty short order 500,000 or a million jobs. Those are the kind of numbers that get Americans, eyes lighting up these days. Do you believe it?
Tom, the jobs picture in the U.S. is very weak, and it's very plausible that we look for culprits outside. The reality is that China is making a difference at the margin, but China is not the only reason or the primary reason why the U.S. manufacturing base is eroding. We are becoming less competitive at the low end of the manufacturing scale, and that is going to be a place that is taken, if not by China, by other low-cost producers. But China is important. Now, we don't really know how much the currency is undervalued. These estimates are all based on rather wild assumptions. The reality is that if China, for instance, were to allow more capital to flow out of its country today, because Chinese citizens are getting very low interest rates on their bank deposits and the banking system is a little shaky, who knows what would happen to the exchange rate? But the reality is that right now the Chinese are definitely intervening in foreign exchange markets to keep their currency low, and it's having a negative effect. So what we need to think about is how we get the Chinese to do something that ultimately is in their own interest, and they know that they need a more flexible currency. The problem that I'm concerned about is that if we make it a U.S.-China bilateral issue and start pounding on them, it's not going to be very productive for us.
Not productive. Why? Because China's got a lot of clout, leverage over the U.S. economy, or hurts everybody? Why?
We have to think when we talk about taking actions about what action we could take. If we tried to impose trade sanctions on them, it would set off a bilateral trade war, which is going to have very negative effect on trade negotiations around the world. Now, President Obama has espoused a goal of doubling U.S. exports in 5 years. Now, the only way to do that is by getting market access, not just in China, but in other countries. And if you have trade negotiations not working well, this is not going to help the U.S. Second, China is buying a fair number of U.S. Treasury bonds, and it's helping to keep interest rates low here. Do we really want interest rates going up right now if China stops buying our bonds? Not really. I don't think it'll come to this nuclear scenario, but really I think we need to think about what effect the actions are going to have towards the end we ultimately want, which is for China to have a more balanced growth path that doesn't depend so much on exports.
Robert Scott, are you toying with trade war here? And if it should come to that, who wins? Who loses? Does all trade diminish and, you know, everybody's economy get hurt?
Well, I don't think it has to come to a trade war. What we've seen in the past, on at least two occasions, is simply the threat of trade sanctions usually is enough to persuade countries like China that are engaged in unfair currency manipulation to stop. That happened, as I said, in 2005 with China. It happened in 1985 with Japan and several of the European countries when we negotiated the Plaza Accord. Very similar situations. Congress threatened trade sanctions. That's all that happened. And the accord was the diplomatic result. I think the key thing to recognize is that the U.S. is not alone in being hurt by China's currency manipulation. Other countries such as Brazil and India and the European Union have also been complaining about the negative impacts of China's currency policies on their economies. I think everybody is sort of waiting for the U.S. to act. I think if we do, it's quite likely these other countries will join in, and it will become a de facto multilateral effort to persuade China to change its currency.
And what about China pulling back from buying U.S. dollars? U.S. interest rates go up. This scenario, exactly what the Fed is working so hard right now not to have happen. I mean, wouldn't that be another path to spiking the U.S. economy?
I think this is really an empty threat completely. I think China would be simply shooting itself in the foot if it were to stop buying U.S. Treasury securities or to sell some of what they have. And we have to remember that right now there is a huge excess supply of savings in the world economy, and the Federal Reserve has essentially unlimited resources to buy up Treasury securities, and they can simply buy more. They're buying hundreds of billions of dollars right now every year. They could buy another $100 billion or two and keep interest rates where they are today. So China has no ability to affect interest rates
China,
in the short run.
China pushing back on this. The China Daily over the last couple of days, headline, China urges U.S. not to sacrifice relations for political expediency. And here's a little bit from China's state-run CCTV over the weekend. This is Professor Xiang Songshu of Renmin University in Beijing, talking about why he thought the U.S. Congress was pushing China so hard right now.
It's a new wave of so-called China bashing, which is forcing China to appreciate RMB. Actually, RMB has appreciated very much in the last few years. Why Congress and the U.S. Politician choose this date to push the new wave of appreciation? I think the Congress middle election is coming, and the Democratic Party as well as President Obama are facing very great challenge.
It's all about the election, says the Chinese scholar there. Ishwar Prasad, give us a more supple sense of why China is doing this. It's obvious it can hear the loud complaints from Washington. This trading relationship is important to China as well. It has responded a little since the first conversations about this over this last summer. But why isn't it, or maybe even why can't it do more? What are its internal dynamics that make this difficult? Are they just, you know, doing this to take home a whole lot of money, or are there bigger reasons?
No, Tom, they're not just thumbing their nose at the U.S. The reality is that there is a very vigorous debate within Chinese political circles. The problem is that they have locked themselves into a model where essentially they're growing largely by investing a lot. In fact, the interesting point is that over the last decade, it's not really been exports that has driven their growth. It's been investment, because Chinese households save a lot all of that money gets funneled through the banking system into state enterprises, which go out and invest a lot. In the last 3 or 4 years, of course, the trade surplus has risen a lot. Now, the problem the Chinese face is that with their growth model, it's just not generating enough jobs because capital is very cheap. They provide cheap land, cheap energy. So the paradox is that in a country that is very rich with labor, in fact, they're using capital-led growth. And that's not creating jobs. The jobs are really coming from the export sector. And this is the tricky part. Whatever little employment growth they're getting comes from exports. So they're very concerned while they're trying to shift the balance of growth to stop losing export markets. And this is why they're terrified about moving on the currency. They know exactly what needs to be done, but their argument has been give us time. But I think, frankly, they are taking too much time because this is hurting them. If they allow their currency to appreciate, their households would essentially have more money to spend, could consume more. This would shift the balance of growth in the right direction. But they're terrified about employment growth because if they can't deliver on employment growth, social stability becomes a problem. So they know exactly what needs to be done, but they're concerned about the U.S. pressuring them to do it too soon.
Robert Scott, Eswar Prasad says China's not just not thumbing its nose at the U.S., but, you know, you've got tough talk in this country. You've got the head of the International President of United Steelworkers, this is Lou Gerard, saying China is disrespecting America. He wrote in the last couple of days, not just that, he says China is flipping the bird at America. They said they would do something about the currency, and then they really didn't. Does China have the latitude to do more without running into big domestic problems, Bob, at home?
Well, actually, I think this—that allowing the yuan or renminbi to appreciate would be good for China. It would reduce inflationary pressure within China, which is a serious problem right now. It would, also force China to reorient its growth strategy, as Eswar has suggested. They are right now relying on exports for growth, which are very capital intensive. They don't have a lot of capital. They've got more labor than capital. They need to be developing sectors of the economy like services and domestic consumer goods that would be less capital intensive. So what they need to do is stimulate domestic demand. And not be so reliant on exports. And I think that would actually help China grow in a more healthy, organic way.
Let's get our listeners in here. Leon in Burlington, Vermont. Leon, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wonder what good putting tariffs on Chinese goods coming into this country is going to do when our companies, our national companies, all the companies in this country, been exporting our jobs to China for years. And all the products that they make and bring back into this country are American jobs that should still be done here in America.
But they're not, you say. So if tariffs went on, Robert Scott, how about it? Would that just crunch profits for American companies who have so much manufactured in China?
I think it would crunch profits for big companies like Walmart that are retailers and are selling cheap goods coming from China. But I think it would create increased profits for companies like Boeing and makers of, as I say, machine tools and medical equipment and other kinds of goods that can benefit from increased export sales. The U.S. still has over 11 million people employed in manufacturing in this country. Those are jobs that would be added to. We'd stimulate growth in those sectors if we could get China to revalue. And again, we don't have to employ a tariff. We simply have to threaten it. The mere threat will be enough to persuade China to revalue.
So you say hasn't been so far. Keith Bradshaw joins us right now. He's Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times. He joins us from Hong Kong. This is not just about currency valuations. He wrote very interestingly recently on how China is supporting its clean energy industry. September 9th on Clean Energy, China Skirts Rules was his story. You can see it at our website, onpointradio.org. Keith, thank you very much for being with us. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me again.
You went into central China, Changsha and Hunan province, and looked at what's going on there with solar energy equipment production and the great lengths to which Chinese governments are going to underwrite, subsidize that business. Tell us about it, Keith.
The subsidies are really very extensive. For example, I spoke to four clean energy companies in the greater Changsha area that all had been allowed to buy land from the government for one-third of the government's usual list price on the grounds that they were going to set up clean energy factories. One of those companies I wrote about had bought 22 acres of prime land near the heart of the city, near the heart of Changsha. They'd paid, I think it was $90,000 an acre for land that was selling for $270,000 at the official government list price. That was 2 years ago. Now the land is worth something more like $800,000, as I recall. So the very large profits on the land that that clean energy companies are allowed to buy from the government, and then in turn they can invest those profits either by borrowing against the land or by doing an initial public offering. They can invest the profits from that in buying a lot more equipment to manufacture clean energy. Most of that, of their solar panels in particular, from China, 95% of them are then exported.
Those go right into markets in the U.S. and beyond. So it's not just currency valuations. Keith, you know, a lot of American communities, states, cities have also given low-cost loans and stepped up to support American manufacturing. It's not only China that does that. Is there a difference in degree or kind here?
The critical question is, are they export subsidies? World Trade Organization rules put a lot of limits on how you can subsidize exports. In fact, basically you can't. You're not allowed to. Most of those American programs are subsidizing goods that will be primarily sold in the United States. That main purpose of those factories is not exports. Therefore, it's much easier for them to meet World Trade Organization rules. Beyond that, also, a lot of the way those programs in the United States are designed are less likely to infringe on free trade rules. For example, American programs to put in new roads tend to do it as a public road, and you're allowed under WTO rules to put in infrastructure, as opposed to, say, building a private road for somebody inside their private land or their private industrial park.
Or their factory grounds. What's the impact on U.S. solar manufacturers, speaking of trade, of the kind of Chinese subsidies for clean energy solar that you reported on, Keith?
It's much more attractive financially now to make solar panels in China than in the United States. BP Solar shut down its factory a couple months ago in Frederick, Maryland, and moved it to Xi'an, China, after getting a great deal from Xi'an. You have Evergreen Solar in Massachusetts, which has already opened its second factory, not in Massachusetts, but in Wuhan. I also visited that factory about an hour north by bullet train from Changsha. Evergreen is planning to move the third of the three major steps in solar panel production from Devens, Massachusetts, to Wuhan next summer and lay off 300 workers in central Massachusetts. So you're seeing the migration of the U.S. industry toward China.
What's the Chinese goal here, Keith?
The Chinese government has a goal of reducing pollution and increasing its reliance on renewable energy and playing a bigger role in what the government sees as an industry of the future. In addition, China's very concerned about energy security. They see their percentage of oil and now coal that comes from overseas rising very quickly, and they worry about it. They worry about not being able to control the oil fields and coal fields that they overseas that they now depend on for their energy. They used to be self-sufficient in energy, and they also worry about the fact that all this oil and coal is coming mainly along sea lanes controlled by the United States Navy or the Indian Navy, and at times they have had frictions with the United States and India, so that it makes them nervous not to be able to have control over their own energy supplies, and for that reason they want to expand their production of solar panels. Finally, it's also an export market.
And presumably a big and growing one. Keith Bradshaw with the New York Times in Hong Kong, thank you so much for being with us, Keith.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China and the U.S. economy in a political season and in a deep economic ditch. There is a lot of tension right now over trade relations between these two big Trading Partners. Robert Scott joins us from Washington. He's at the Economic Policy Institute there. And they are estimating that the U.S. could bring back half a million or a million jobs if China's currency was pegged at a more advantageous point for the U.S. Ishwar Prasad joins us. He's a professor of trade policy at Cornell. He says, be careful, watch out. Let's get a call from Josh in Charleston, South Carolina. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question, I guess, is plainly, as a country with such a deficit that we have and is certainly indebted to China, what type of political or positional stronghold do we actually have to offer, being that we owe them so much money already?
A good question. We'll pick it up. Ishwar Prasad, Robert Scott says, just threaten and you could get action. Josh looks at, you know, how much American debt China holds and doesn't sound so sure of that leverage.
Tom, the leverage is something that is limited. We still do have access to our export markets that we give to the Chinese. But I think both Robert Scott and Keith Bradshaw have touched upon one important point, which is far more important than currency in my view, which is that the low-skill, low-wage manufacturing we are losing in the U.S., not just to China, but other countries. So if it's not China, it's going to be other low-wage manufacturers taking the place. Where the U.S. really has a competitive advantage is in terms of higher tech, higher value-added production. And that precisely is where China is trying to make very significant inroads, not just through the sort of subsidies that Keith Bradshaw is talking about, but by spending enormous amounts on infrastructure, by supporting those industries, and by limiting market access within China to those industries from abroad.
I want to be sure I'm following you, Professor Prasad. So are you saying this is nothing to do with the currency issue? Of course, it's behind all export work there. Are you saying we should be looking at other kinds of export subsidies here? I mean, that's not low-skill manufacturing. Solar panels, that's getting up high.
That's exactly the point, and that's where the U.S. is very competitive right now. But if we allow China to move along with those policies where it protects those industries, while those industries within China become stronger, they are going to take away our competitiveness at the higher end of the manufacturing scale.
But that sounds like an argument for a trade fight here right now.
Right, but that's the set of issues we should be focusing on. So currency is going to be very important, but ultimately a 10% differential or 20% differential on the currency is not what is going to matter. And behind the scenes, this is actually exactly the set of issues that the administration is focusing on. So during the strategic and economic dialogue, which is a bilateral dialogue with China held twice a year, in their meetings with Chinese officials, they are focusing on this policy. China has a rather dangerous policy called indigenous innovation, which is basically giving Chinese companies or companies that do their innovation in China preference in the government procurement process. This shuts out a lot of high-tech U.S. manufacturers from the Chinese market while the Chinese are building up their own high-tech sector.
Okay,
is a prospect.
Yeah, it's a tough time in this country, and it's a hot-blooded political time. I mean, here's one of our web comment from our website. A listener saying, here's what we ought to do. Cut ties with China, erect high tariff barriers to foreign goods, begin to rebuild American industrial capacity, protect the American workers and their way of life. What about that as a recipe, Professor Prasad?
I think the rebuilding industrial capacity is really a critical part, and we need to think about what set of policies in the U.S. we can adapt in order to maintain this, because what China is doing is investing very strategically in infrastructure, education, and things which support manufacturing. So I think we need to be asking whether we're doing the same thing in this country. So this is not to say that Chinese currency policy does not matter, but my fear again is that by focusing on China as the key problem, we're really missing out on much more important aspects of the problem.
Louis in Worcester, Massachusetts. Louis, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to say that I have firsthand experience with this, dealing with the Chinese. I'm a small manufacturer, and for a company that's been in business for over 35 years, we're seeing a hit in the last year with our raw material prices. Chinese companies are bringing stuff into the United States for less money than we can even buy raw materials for here in the United States, and it's really hit us hard, and we're about we are off about 90% from last year business-wise.
And they're bringing in finished products at the cost of your raw materials. What should happen here, Louis?
I don't know. The market that we deal with is pretty much the same all over the world for raw materials. It's not fluctuated by any other, you know, market economy other than, you know, what the market price is. But Chinese, from subsidies, I assume, are bringing it in cheaper than we can even buy raw materials for here.
And you're taking a 90% hit. We hear that. Robert Scott, you hear that story, and here's a comment from the web. Tatiana says, I'd like to hear just exactly how the U.S. can change its trade dynamics with China. She writes, you cannot force a government like China's to change its currency valuation policies or buy more American goods or to change the way it treats and pays its own citizens, for that matter. She writes, it's easy enough to bully countries like Iran, North Korea, Cuba, not so easy, but China is a different story. Yeah, you make it sound awfully easy, Robert Scott. Just threaten and then everything will change, but really?
Well, in the 1980s, the big problem was Japan, and everybody thought Japan was going to be the next giant country on the world stage. And we were able to successfully threaten Japan with tariffs, and Japan did agree to revalue its currency. At that point, the U.S. had a huge trade deficit that effectively went away. It declined from about 3%, 3.5% of GDP in 85 down to essentially nothing by 1991. So we can address this problem through currency policies. And now, is that enough? No, I think Professor Prasad is absolutely right. We need to have a multi-leg strategy to try to rebuild U.S. manufacturing. I think in a nutshell, we've got to focus on currency and unfair trade policies, such as the energy subsidies Keith Bradshaw's talked about. I think we've got to focus on investments in clean energy and other advanced technologies, and I think we have to focus on infrastructure. I think we're going to have to do all three of those things at once if we're going to rebuild the productive side of our economy.
Ishwar Prasad, where do you see the leverage here? There's a lot to be done at home. No question about that. We can never lose sight of that. But you're talking about China's indigenous innovation program. You know, that sounds like protectionism in a nutshell. If it goes to trade policy, maybe they'll move the currency a little bit. Maybe they won't. But how does China's got its own big goals and seems very intent on them. It has its own political pressures at the back of Beijing. How do you see the U.S., to Tatiana's question, sort of tilting the board a little bit more in its own favor here?
Now, the reality is that this Japanese experience that Dr. Scott mentioned, the Chinese have taken exactly the opposite lesson from it. They said, look, the U.S. threatened Japan. Japan gave in to the threats, and look where Japan is today. So, in fact, that is causing them to reconsider any notion of caving in to the threats. Now, what the U.S. can really do is bring other countries together, because the reality is that it's not just that the U.S. that is being hurt by Chinese currency policy. It is other advanced economies and, more importantly, other emerging markets that are finding their exports being taken over by Chinese exports. But the problem is that China is using its political and economic heft very, very effectively across the world, and the U.S. needs to find a way to counterbalance that, because the U.S. is still a very strong power, and we need to rally around the troops, so to speak, to make sure that one can approach this not just as a U.S.-China bilateral issue, but as one that is relevant for the entire world economy. And I think we need to bring other emerging markets especially on board. And that, I think, will also make it easier for China to swallow the message that it's not just coming from the U.S., but from the broader international community.
Interesting. We've got comments here on what we heard earlier about some of the divided interests or divided loyalties even of big U.S. companies. Here's Nick. He writes, shipping jobs to China is excellent for companies, but only for employees at the top, and terrible for the other 90% of the employees. Curious about those dynamics. And here's Robert in Nashville, Tennessee. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi. How y'all doing?
Pretty well. What do you see, Robert?
I say instead of going after a country that we owe all this money to and where we need to strengthen our ties, I say we go after the Benedict Arnold United States companies that are leaving here by raising their quadrupling their taxes to where it doesn't make sense for them to leave.
But how do we do that? I mean, GM now, one of its best growth markets is in China. It's struggling back here. Tax it more, you could kill the whole goose, Robert.
Well, we bring in people in this country to build our houses. We ship all of our jobs. Everybody can't sit at a computer. You know, we've got to think of the American worker at some point.
I hear you loud and clear right there, Robert Scott. What about the American interests in China? You know, Robert's saying let's take some action on those multinational interests, try and turn their business, their jobs back home.
Well, I think multinational businesses, whether they're based here or in China or in Europe, they respond to market signals. And the market signals have been distorted by policies like currency manipulation and subsidies in China. So I think the lever that we have is to try to get China to stop manipulating those market signals, to get the signals right, to get the currency value right, to eliminate these unfair subsidies. And again, I want to distinguish between China's dependence on exports to the U.S., something like, and to other countries. Approximately a third of China's total output, their total gross domestic product, is dependent on exports to the U.S. and the rest of the world. That is where we have the leverage. On the other hand, less than half of 1% of our economy depends on exports to China. So there's a huge imbalance there. The surplus country in these kinds of situations is always much more vulnerable. And the debt is simply irrelevant. That is, as we would say in the poker world, that's dead money. It's gone. It's not coming back. And it's China's problem. But what China is really most, dependent on today is their continuing flow of exports to the U.S. and other countries.
You say the U.S. debt to China is irrelevant, but doesn't this country and its interest rates continue to depend in some degree on that flow of dollars being bought by China? I know you said earlier the Fed can do whatever it likes, but we're up in pretty big numbers here. Does China really have no leverage with all holding all that American debt?
Right now, U.S. companies are sitting on a stash of approximately $2 trillion in surplus cash. They don't know what to do with it. They're running around buying up their own stock, buying up other countries. There's simply a huge excess supply of savings in this country available. China holds about $875 billion worth of U.S. Treasury bills. On the other hand, the Federal Reserve in the last 2 years has acquired about $2 trillion worth of assets. Clearly, the Fed has plenty of money, plenty of ability to print money to buy up any treasury bills that China should ever decide to try and sell, if it were so foolish just to try and do that.
So you say a third of China's economy, that's huge, depends on exports. The U.S. has just a tiny fraction that depends on sales to China. So let's say that the United States began to try and use that leverage in a way that pinched China, in a way that really got their attention. And they didn't just fold, they wanted to push back. How might they do it?
Well, that's the question. How could they do it? They really have very little leverage. Perhaps the most valuable thing they have right now is they have tied up world markets in things like rare earth metals. What they've done is monopolize that market by buying up plants around the world. And today, the only country you can buy rare earth metals from is China, and they're used in everything. They're used in batteries for cell phones, computer chips, you name it, smart bombs, you name it. It requires rare earth elements. So that's really China's, I think, big ace in the hole. And, that's where the competition could get tough. But, frankly, we need to also think about that issue and begin to develop our own alternative sources of those materials.
Iswar Prasad, do you agree that when the rubber hits the road, China really has very little leverage in this standoff? I mean, does it really just boil down to who's got molybdenum?
Let me first correct a fact for the record. China's economy has about 30% attributable to exports, and about one-fifth of that goes to the U.S. So it is true that the U.S. is the single most important export market, but it's still a fifth of their exports. It's about 6% of GDP, not one-third of the economy. But still, it's a very important fraction because, again, it does matter for job growth. But again, the reality is that if one-third of the overall economy is accounted for by exports, again, remember there are imports on the other side balancing some of this, but still getting other countries together with the U.S. is really going to be the key issue. In terms of the debt, it is true that right now China does not have much leverage because there are no inflationary pressures in this country. But it's hard to believe that with the amount of money floating around in this country, inflationary pressures are not going to begin to rise. And at that point, China would have a significant amount of leverage.
Why?
And I don't think because At that point, if China showed that it was not going to be willing to buy U.S. Treasury bonds, it would to some extent be shooting itself in the foot. But I think they're willing to do that if national pride is at stake. That would significantly hurt the U.S. economy, because then you could have other countries as well starting to worry about U.S. Government bonds, given the size of the deficit. And that could have a pretty negative effect on the U.S. economy. I don't want to overstate it, but I don't think it's clear that we have enormous leverage over China and China has little leverage over us. The complex problem is that it is quite balanced right now, and we need to use whatever levers we have in a sensible way, rather than feeling that we have the balance of power here.
Is there a reason these two economies can't both prosper in this trade relationship? Is there a structural problem here, Iswas Prasad, or not?
Now, ultimately, both countries have problems that they need to solve on their own. China needs to have a much more balanced growth path, which is going to be much better for China. Their people will benefit much more from the fantastic growth that they are achieving. Plus, they will be able to pull in more imports from the U.S. and abroad. So in that sense, that's going to be good for China and good for the U.S. So I don't think this is a zero-sum game. And focusing on this bilateral issue and raising tensions on currency, I think could, in fact, end up making it a zero-sum game, which it doesn't have to be.
Well, I'm guessing we're going to hear a lot more about that game in the weeks ahead. You've given us a lot of insight into what's going on there and how the world really looks on this axis. I want to thank you both for being here. Iswar Prasad, Senior Professor of Trade Policy at Cornell University, joining us from Ithaca, New York. Thanks very much for being with us again, Professor Prasad.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you for having me.
And Robert Scott, Senior International Economist, Director of International Programs at the Economic Policy Institute. You can read his September 20th issue brief for EPI, Rising China Trade Deficits Will Cost 500,000 Jobs in the U.S. by 2010, at our website, onpointradio.org. Robert Scott, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.